Life Show on UK Health Radio. I'm Robin Daly, regular host for the show and founder of the UK charity Yes to Life, which was set up to help people with cancer find out all their options for care. My guest today is someone I've spoken to before on the show and who is very passionate about lifestyle medicine and about traditional medicine. Dr. Sam Watts has been taking a particular interest in chronobiology, a relatively new discipline that is just beginning to have an impact on the thinking and practice of some healthcare providers. I'm talking to Dr. Watts over the phone at his practice in East Wittering on the South Coast. Hi Sam, really pleased to have you back on the Yes to Life show.
Oh, it's a privilege to be back, so thank you for... I'm pleased I didn't put you off the first time
around. Actually, I really enjoyed our discussion last time, and so I'm really looking forward to this. Today we're going to head out into territory that hasn't had a lot of attention on the Yes to Life show, but it is gaining more attention in the world of integrative oncology and wider, and that is the subject of chronobiology, as it's now called, the science of the cycles we operate within as humans. So on the face of it, it would be easy to dismiss this as maybe interesting, but largely unimportant to someone facing something as serious as cancer. But what would you say to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the complete opposite, actually, and I think we're going to be seeing so much more of this in not just the medical literature and the science literature, but in terms of common knowledge, because as soon as someone wins a Nobel Prize, you know that the research is incredibly robust, and two, it's going to be incredibly impactful as it begins to be unravelled in the years subsequent to winning it. And that's exactly what chronobiology and the circadian rhythm has done. In 2017 it won the Nobel Prize, and the implications of that have been absolutely profound, because in terms of how does this slightly abstract concept relate to health, it's the answer that's such a huge question, and the simple answer is it has a very profound impact, and particularly in the arena of cancer, where survivorship takes on quite a broad and we should take on a broad and integrated approach with diet and lifestyle and supplements and all those bits and pieces. And what the research around chronobiology is showing is that every single one of those variables and dozens of other variables are all either helped or hindered by the fact whether we're living in keeping with our daily routines or we're not. So it has, unequivocally, I think to my mind, without exception, it has a profound role to play in keeping us well, preventing illness and helping in the management of illness, particularly cancer, definitely.
How interesting. Right. Well, we've got plenty to dig into today. I really want to find out some more about this. So let's start out by defining the territory. Can you give us a definition of chronobiology? What's being studied and why?
Yeah, so chronobiology is, I guess, an advancement of the circadian rhythm. So I think most people have heard of circadian rhythm, which is the 24-hour cycle, the biological cycle in the human body, for all every plant, all the different kingdoms, vegetable kingdom, animal kingdom. And it's to do with how our bodies change over given cycles, over the rotation of the planet. As the planet spins on its axis, what effect does that have on the way the body works? And if that affects the way the body works, then it has to have, unequivocally, it has to have an impact upon whether we're moving towards health or whether we're moving towards illness. It has to support one of those mechanisms. So the whole field now is, it's a rapidly emerging field, and it's a rapidly progressing field of chronobiology. Is how far can this go? What level is this working at? How impactful can it be? Can we translate that into protocols and mechanisms that we can give to people to facilitate health promotion and disease management? And how do we do that? So in terms of defining the field, the field of chronobiology is using our body's biological clock to make the body work more effectively, to ramp up health and to mobilize the mechanisms in the body, like the immune system, our digestive system, our hormone system, to make sure they're working as effectively as they can. So in a nutshell, that's the territory, I suppose, around what chronobiology is trying to mobilise.
Yeah, fascinating, really. I mean, the contrast. I mean, you're talking about this now with a kind of certainty that's backed up by science. What an incredibly short time ago this would have been, you know, strictly for crystal gazing hippies.
Yeah. And the other thing that makes it even more ironic is, you know, Ayurvedic medicine is my main my main passion. It's you know what we practice clinically, and Ayurveda is such a broad area. I mean, it goes back 5,000 years. It's a system of medicine. It's a system of spirituality. It's a system of philosophy. But the one of the overarching tenets or concepts of Ayurveda is that, you know, what affects the macrocosm affects the microcosm, which sounds a little bit, you know, esoteric and woo-hoo. But what it's essentially saying is that we're not separate. The elements and the components that make up a tree or a giraffe or a rock, it make up the human body as well. So anything that affects the outside world will affect the inside world. And if you look at the statements that came out from the Nobel Prize, it's literally a carbon copy of what Ayurveda has been saying for 5,000 years, which is that for the human body to work, it has to work in sync with the planet. And they released a statement. I've got a quote here that I wrote down. This is from the Nobel Prize winning research. It said, "Chronic misalignment between our lifestyle and our inner body clock is now shown to be associated with increased risk factors for disease prevalence." And that, you know, that is almost a carbon copy of a statement or a sutra in one of the Ayurvedic texts that's about 2,500 years old, which says exactly the same thing, that if we're living a life that's not aligned with the world we live in, we will become ill. So it is, even 7 years ago, I remember going to a conference in Berlin, and this was being discussed, and it was essentially being publicly ridiculed when the person was presenting the information. It was, you know, we received a huge amount of criticism. I think why that Nobel Prize was so important was because it picked it up and it embedded it very much into the Western evidence-based arena, and that's what it needed to give it the kudos, I suppose, that it needs to be taken seriously.
How much quicker would things move on if that process of attacking anything new was just laid to one side and people were a bit more open-minded?
Been endemic all the way through the history of science. And it's so frustrating.
Yeah, but it's even talked about something good, you know, so that's how we do it, you know, we take things to bits robustly and, you know, all this stuff. It's sort of, there's a language around it which makes it sound good, but actually it's just opposition to change, isn't it?
Yeah, that's exactly what it is, and that's probably one of the biggest barriers in science, isn't it? This idea, this risk of a lot of work, decades of work often being undone by one powerful new study that changes the goalpost and changes the paradigm. I think that will always meet resistance, but I think it's one of those things, it's moving beyond our thoughts and our ego, isn't it, and saying what's best for serving people and serving, you know, healthcare and humanity, and what can give people more tools. And one of the reasons I think that the chronobiology is going to become very important in some of the public health and public health measures and in the self-care movement and the lifestyle medicine movement is that it's so autonomous and it's so empowering, because it doesn't, once you've got the framework for it and once you understand the concept, you don't need anyone to help you do it.
Right.
It's just, you know, no other mammal on the planet, you know, every mammal on the planet other than us, when they studied them, they're living in keeping with the body, with the planet's rhythms. They get up at the right times, they typically eat at the right times, they sleep at the right times, their hormone profiles are right, because they haven't got light bulbs and internet and all of the things that, you know, stop us living naturally, I suppose.
Yes.
And what I love about it is that, you know, just with some subtle changes, very small changes to the way we live our lives, we can have this very, very, or now clinically proven impact upon the way our body's working and whether it's, you know, more healthy or less healthy. And I love that because it's giving health autonomy to people. It's not requiring anyone else to, you don't need to go to see anyone to get this stuff. It's just, it's a simple way of, I think whenever health becomes simple, you know you're onto a winner. It
right.
It gets much more simple than this, I think.
That's a very, I really like that summary there, yeah. And yeah, I think, you know, that's a kind of core feature of a lot of lifestyle medicine, isn't it? It is things you can do yourself, which is marvellous, because you're recapturing, if you like, the ability to maintain your own health.
Yeah, and that's surely what health is about, isn't it? You know, if we get very sick, it's great to call in experts, it's that ability to empower ourselves. We're not always, it's that idea of it putting ourselves at the middle of the picture, isn't it? And saying, well, I'm going to take the very best from conventional medicine and integrative medicine, but I'm still at the core of this, and this is what I'm going to do to dominate this situation. And I think you've got to pull in a lot of different approaches from different areas. And I think to leave chronobiology out of that now doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense. Clinically, it doesn't make any sense. In terms of the self-care and the lifestyle movement. People need to understand it. They need to understand why it works, what gains it can give you, and what are some simple approaches I can utilize to make sure I'm tapping into this system. It definitely, I think we'll see that. I can't see how, it's like green tea and turmeric and meditation. You know, 10 years ago, you know, those things weren't as well known about, but now virtually everyone on the street knows that turmeric gives you. Most people know green tea gives you these benefits. People that were staunchly against meditation have now opened up to the idea that actually call it something different, but we know that it changes aging mechanisms and hormones and chemicals that, you know, that optimize health. And I think chronobiology is going to be like that. Everyone's going to know about it because they need to know about it. And that's a good thing. That can only be a good thing.
Absolutely. It's interesting. There's a kind of circle we've come around where we started off doing all these things naturally, like everything else. We moved further and further and further and further away from them. And then we start to learn then. And then we have to actually choose consciously to do the things we used to do naturally.
It's one of the statements that was used until the literature came off the back of the Nobel Prize, which is the idea that in the Western world we're progressing backwards. And I love that idea. They were talking of all these advancements and all this technology that's designed to make life easier and less burdensome and less complicated.
Yes.
It does the complete opposite, isn't it? It's maybe the light bulb was evolved and developed so we could have light in the dark. What does that mean? It means we could work longer.
Yeah, right.
It means we could work at midnight when we should be asleep, and all of these things that, you know, internet and all the other bits and pieces, which are, you know, have brought so many benefits, but it's contaminated us to a point that, and I think internet, you know, I say that flippantly, but they're saying the internet, and particularly social media, is probably one of the biggest barriers to adopting healthy chronobiology into our lives, because it's so easy at 10 o'clock, 10:30 in the evening, when our hormone profile is saying, you know, you are, evolutionary speaking, primed for deep sleep now. Suddenly, just before you go to bed, you walk past your phone, you see a pin or a message from Instagram or Facebook or an email, you check that, and straight away you get a dump of cortisol. So your melatonin drops, and then you're not as well primed for sleep. And just that one variable, you know, can impact upon what happens that night, the quality of our sleep. That affects our immune parameters and our inflammatory parameters, and then you extrapolate that, you know, weeks and months and even years, and suddenly you can see how these small things, you know, can be very, very harming or very, very healing, depending upon which way we're going. So there's a bit of a backlash against the role of technology and internet and social media on chronobiology, but that's a whole other, that's a real minefield.
All right, it is. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's definitely going full circle.
So there's a lot of talk about our internal body clocks. Where or what are these actually, and what do they control?
So it's still the million dollar question, in that whilst the Nobel Prize was able to identify, you know, with such precision a variety of genes that are responsible for it, what it's also done is it's opened the door to saying there's a lot more. But essentially what the biological clock is about is how the genes they've identified that control the way our cells I've switched on or switched off or activated or deactivated or controlled and, you know, put into dormancy or sped up, depending upon where we are on the rotation of the planet. So the whole concept of the chronobiology now has moved from being something quite broad, like, okay, we know at 4 or 5 in the morning our body starts secreting cortisol to start waking us up, which is quite a broad, you know, it's incredibly important, but it's quite a broad concept. To actually, okay, what genetically is going on that's facilitating that mechanism? And actually, melatonin is a really key. Melatonin and cortisol are the two heavyweights in that capacity, because what it shows is when we're asleep, you know, from 10, 10:30, 11 in the evening till about 5 in the morning, when melatonin is high, then that allows certain compounds to build up in cells. And then once the melatonin drops and the cortisol starts being secreted in the early hours of the morning, you know, 5, 4, 5, 6, which prepares us to wake up, those chemicals in the cells are then secreted out. And that then is the catalyst for what happens, controlling blood pressure, immunity, the difference between what our body needs to be in during the waking state and the waking hours when it's daylight compared to when we're asleep at nighttime. And it's poles apart. If you look at what functions and what variables the body needs to be controlling at 2 in the morning, it's almost like a different body compared to the same variables at 2 in the afternoon.
Interesting.
And that's what chronobiology is about, is, you know, why is this happening and why is it so important and what's responsible for it. So it's really honed in now into the genetic level, rather than just being slightly broader, you know, hormone profiling and the like.
Right. So in terms of the idea of a body clock, from the way you're speaking, is it fair to say that the body clock is not so much as something we have in us, but we're part of, in as much as it seems like you're talking about responses that we have to the solar system, to everything that's happening around us?
Exactly. That's exactly it, which is that idea again of, you know, so as in the macrocosm, so in the microcosm.
Right.
It's not. Because even, you know, the study of the circadian rhythm goes back to 1788. So even you know, 3 centuries ago, you know, people, physicians and scientists were aware that our body changes across the 24-hour cycle. So it's an old concept. Obviously, Ayurvedic, it goes back even further than that. It goes back thousands of years. But it's exactly that. It's not something that is an isolated mechanism that happens in the body. It is the body. Exactly that. It is the body.
Right.
You know, it affects every single cell. It's affecting us at our genetic level. You know, anything that affects us at our genetic level, that's embedded in our genes, it's core to our makeup. It's what makes us who we are. And it's, you know, it's in all of us. And that's exactly that. You know, it's exactly that fact that it's not something that happens to us, it is us. And that's, I think, if you look at the way the research has developed after that Nobel Prize was, you know, after that publication, that's where it's going. It's not a case of saying, okay, we've identified these 16 genes.
Right.
What they're suggesting is it's probably the tip of the iceberg.
Right.
If you look at most of these breakthroughs, when they come out, they're earth-shattering. But 5 years later, they're a needle in a haystack, I suppose, compared to what has come about since it. And I think that's definitely true in chronobiology, in that there's probably dozens and dozens and dozens more genes. There's probably even more subtle cellular mechanisms that are responsible for whether chronobiology is helping us or harming us. So it is us. It's us at our core. It's our genes. It's ourselves. It saturates every part of who we are. So chronobiology is not something we can ignore. It's affecting us whether we like it or not. We have no say in being involved in it. The only thing we have a say in is whether we use it to help us or we're living in a way that's harming us. So
right.
It is us. You're absolutely right. Chronobiology is us. It's in our body. Which is interesting.
It's very interesting. Okay, so if there's one aspect of this subject that's kind of made it into the mainstream, it's the one you've mentioned already. It's this kind of getting a screen out late in the evening and the effect this can have on our sleep and much more. So One of the most talked about aspects of that, you talked about the, what you actually read, and but there's also the aspect of the light from the machines, which has been made into the media a lot. So this...
The blue light.
The blue light, that's right. And there's a bit of research behind this. We've got quite a complex relationship with light, which involves a receptor that up until quite recently, well, we didn't even know we had it. So can you just talk a bit more about the effects of late night browsing?
It's all this complexity of things, new receptors, new cells, neurons being found. But what they, the headline is what they've now proved almost unequivocally is blue light. So anything emitted from tablets, smartphones, etc., they're now proven to suppress melatonin, and not just suppress melatonin, but also increase the release of stress hormones.
Right.
Even if we're reading or listening to something that's quite calming. So, and the problem with that is that's the impact upon our physiology and our biochemistry and our sleep mechanisms are profound, because one of the key areas around the circadian rhythm and chronobiology is that we have these absolute peaks, these two peaks. There's a hormonal peak when we're optimally primed to get up in the morning, and there's a hormonal peak where we're optimally primed to go to sleep. Anything that supports and facilitates those peaks will make getting up and going to bed easier, and anything that disrupts them will make getting up harder and getting to sleep more difficult. And I think if you go on the weight of evidence, there's loads of things that can affect melatonin. For most people, statistically, they say the optimal time to shut our eyes to sleep is about 10:30-ish, 10:30 to 11. So our melatonin is absolutely primed to embed deep, restorative, restful sleep. But even just suddenly, picking up the tablet, reading the news, checking the coronavirus statistics, particularly these things that are quite fear-inducing, TikTok news, for example, those kinds of things, not only are our eyes picking up the blue light, which then suppresses and reduces melatonin, but suddenly our brain, if our brain sees another victim dying of coronavirus or another outbreak, another war or a conflict kicking in, the brain doesn't know the difference between what it's seeing and reading in reality. It will respond to a threat, whether the threat is 1,000 miles away or if it's in our own house, and we get a small secretion of stress hormone. So doubled up, as melatonin drops and cortisol increases, it's so hard to get to sleep with that software profile, because what it's saying, I don't want you to go to sleep because something stressed me out, and as far as I'm concerned, there's a proverbial saber-toothed tiger in the room.
All right.
From evolutionary days gone by. So the blue light, I think, we see it in our clinic, people coming in who've got sleep dysfunction. And before you use anything else, any of the herbal protocols or prescriptions, if you just get their evening routine very, 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 very robust, and then you put a curfew on smartphones, emails, tablets after 8:30,
right,
you usually get about a 50% improvement in sleep quality and quota straight off the bat within a week. And I think the beauty of that research is that it's now, the melatonin, the impact of blue light on melatonin, it's not a question of can it, might it, could it. It's unequivocal. It's accepted that blue light suppresses melatonin. Even if people just look at the field of chronobiology and say, okay, I'm interested and it's exciting, but I don't know how much time I've got to tweaking this, that, and the other. If they just did one thing, if they put a curfew on blue light from 8:30 in the evening, if that gave you an extra hour of quality sleep a night, that's 7 hours a week of rest. And now when you're given the science showing how important sleep is to our health, that just tapping into that one tiny component of the collective chronobiology field could give us a huge gain in energy and vitality and immunity and a whole range of variables. So there's no question, anyone listening to this, if you're looking at blue light after 8:30 in the evening, it's not going to be helping you. The research is absolutely clear on that.
Right, okay, that's interesting. And just to mention that TVs are in the same territory, but not as bad. Is that right?
There's quite a lot of varying statistics on how bad they become, and it's quite hard to draw conclusions from that because of the heterogeneity, I suppose, of the research, but it doesn't seem to be anywhere near as bad as tablets and smartphones.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons they're saying is usually a TV is, I don't know, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 feet away,
right.
Whereas a tablet or a smartphone is often maybe only a foot away from our head.
Yeah.
So it has a greater capacity to induce change. But yeah, tellies aren't great, but they're definitely nowhere near as bad as the smartphones and the tablets.
Right. So now I want to do a bit of a Daily Mail now. You just put out the certainty behind the science on that, but then no sooner have people sort of started to take that on board that blue light is bad, and they've got the specially designed software in their computer that makes it go yellower as the evening goes on and this kind of thing, then research from Manchester University suggests it's nothing to do with blue at all, but only with brightness regardless of the colour. In fact, they found in their studies, which let's be honest here, this is with mice, not people, but they found that the blue was more restful than the yellow. So, you know, it sounds like this is what you call emerging science. You know, we know there's something going on, but we haven't got much of a clue what.
But this is what I find frustrating with science. This is what humans do.
Yeah.
They focus in on the specifics. But I think it's a step back from that and look at what they're saying there. They're saying, it's fine to be in bed 11 o'clock at night, scrolling on your tablet. The bigger question, is it yellow light or blue light?
Right.
that's not the question. The question is, we need to get people to understand that we're not designed to be, at that time of the evening, doing something that stimulates the brain. Whether it's blue light, green light, red light, it doesn't, okay, you might get a 10% risk factor from using that light, or this app can reduce emissions and this, that and the other.
Yes.
But that's another case of humans problem solving rather than getting to the root cause of the problem.
Okay.
Which is, why, people's days are so full up. Why do we need to continue that level of intensity and output into 10, 11, 12 o'clock at night? Why can't we get to a point where we say, okay, it's 9 o'clock now, I've had a busy day, I'm pretty tired, I'm gonna honor my body's natural rhythms, I'm gonna honor the rhythms that humans have followed since we stood up, and I'm gonna wind down now, I'm gonna do things that relax me, and I'm gonna prepare my body for a good night's sleep so I can wake up tomorrow and be healthy and energized and be the best version of myself rather than needing 3 cups of coffee to feel alive. And I think that this is the problem with things like chronobiology. People are trying to find solutions to it rather than just looking at it as what it is. And I think that's the problem with science. It's saying it's focusing on the micro detail and ignoring the macro.
Right.
That's just my opinion. I'm sure that will. There's very clear challenges to that point of view.
Yeah.
But that's the way I view it. That's the way I see it. That it's ignoring the bigger issue here as a society, I think.
Well, very interesting, and it seems like an attempt to carry on the same behaviour by using technology, and I would agree with you in that, is that, of course, we already have one very robust piece of mechanism on, say, our computer, which is the sleep control, where you can put your computer to sleep and it's all done. So the computer gets some and we get some.
Yeah.
Okay, so... one thing I wanted to just talk about a little bit, just because I think it's interesting, is that forever people have known that some people are morning people and some people are evening people. And this is now something which is getting addressed to some extent within this field of chronobiology. You start to begin to understand the things that are controlling this kind of thing. But it's very clear, isn't it, that some people are a waste of space first thing in the morning and vice versa.
Yeah. Yeah, and again, this is where the emerging fields of science go to that transitionary period where it's frustrating because there's always anomalies. And the question of morning larks and night owls is one of the main bone of contention, because there's been three studies that I've read where they looked at people who classify themselves as night owls. Get the 10 o'clock comes around in the evening and they can feel their energy going up, their cognitive clarity improves, and they'll work till 3 in the morning. It's quite common apparently amongst graphic designers, people that are creative individuals who can do it on their computer. And they'll go to bed at 4, maybe not wake up until 11 in the morning, and that cycle will go through. And they've done a few, well, they've done those three trials. They pick those people up and they've taken them into residential centres where they can control the variables.
Yes.
And they bring them forward by half an hour or an hour over a period of time until they're going to bed at around 11 o'clock or midnight rather than 3 in the morning, and then seeing what happens. And actually what they're saying is that, like most things, humans are so adaptive. And if we get to a point where we're, you know, years are going down the line and we're used to going to bed at 3,
mm-hmm.
it's not great, but the body will adapt to it. Actually, if you start reining it back in, I think it was about 89% of the people who were going to bed at 3 were suddenly going to bed at about 11, 11.30 or sometimes 12, and having better hormone profiles. Okay, some of their immune markers and inflammatory markers were better, and they're saying that the outcome of that, those studies were confusing, because they're saying how much is nature and how much is nurture.
Yes.
how much control we've got over this. And then there's other studies that completely fly in the face of that and say some people are morning, you know, a lot. They wake up early and they're vital, and then they fade in the evening, and vice versa. And I think there's probably a degree of that, because humans are a lot more complex than other mammals.
Yes.
And we've got a lot more, you know, we're conscious of our consciousness, and we can use that to control and modify the way we behave. And so I think there's a big question mark over that. I think my take on the research is there probably is a split cohort where you get a certain a cohort who definitely are better in the morning, just the way they're made. In the same reason someone's got blue eyes or someone's got brown eyes, you're just made in a way that you thrive in the morning, or you thrive later into the evening.
Right.
But I do think that they're quite small percentages of the collective. I think as in terms of, it's like any public health initiative, it's got to apply to the masses. And I think in terms of the masses, most people, I think, fall under the umbrella of the general chronobiology structure generally.
Right. So you're saying that most people are doing it to themselves, in fact. It's not their nature. They've actually, through habit or you know, just the way they live, they've actually made their body conform to that kind of a cycle.
Yeah, their body's adapted. Again, because those people, going back 500 years, if you pick up someone who's working at the computer at 3 in the morning, they wouldn't have had that capacity to have done that, because
no.
It wouldn't have been, well, one wouldn't be computers, so it wouldn't be light. So what if you look at that, they're saying that most of the variations and the dysfunction in sleep patterns has come about because we've got the option to do it.
Yeah.
And when there's an option, people are always, you know, press the boundaries on what can I do here? Well, suddenly if I can work till 1 in the morning and feel good on that, I can get extra 3 hours of work, and that's huge for me, because it means my business can achieve X, Y, and Z.
Yeah.
So people always push the boundaries, but I think what chronobiology does is says, well, what price? At what price is that boundary being pushed?
Right,
so I think we can. I think everyone, you know, the long haul pilots, you know, they've been studied almost ad nauseum around this, because their health profiles are very, very, very bad.
Are they?
In terms of certain disease risk factors, yeah, in terms of that blood sugar, cholesterol levels, inflammatory markers, infection rates, certain chronic disease profiles. And what they're saying is if you think about that statement I wrote I mentioned earlier on, from the Nobel Prize work, so chronic misalignment between our lifestyle and our inner clock is now shown to be associated with an increased risk factor for chronic disease.
Yes.
If you're a long-haul pilot, you pretty much don't have a circadian rhythm.
No, I see that.
The apparatus in your brain and your hypothalamus and all the other bits and pieces, they're chronically, it's not just for a year, you know, over decades, they're chronically crossing international time zones.
Yes.
And it doesn't know whether it's coming or going. And I think the implication, in terms of, you know, the cancer context, I think this is where the implications become very exciting, because nutritionally speaking, I think, I'm sure you've seen it all the way through your involvement with Yes to Life. Nutrition, you know, is a fundamental component, isn't it, of the survivorship movement and all recovery from cancer and most illnesses. But the key thing, if you look at some of the changes around nutritional medicine, what they're increasingly showing now, they're showing it now, is that, you know, what we eat, what we put into our body, is probably no more than 50% of the equation. In that, unless we can extract those nutrients, we've read all the books, we've made these amazing changes to our diet because we're recovering from cancer, and we're getting in our antioxidants and flavonoids and all the rest of it, unless we're able to physically extract those micronutrients and vitamins and minerals and antioxidants and send them into the tissues so the body can use them, essentially we're just excreting a large percentage. So the nutritional model is now saying good food, it was robust digestion. Because our digestive system is obviously what allows us to extract nutrients. Mm-hmm. And if there's one, if there's two areas where chronobiology is most relevant, from what I've read, it's the immune system and the digestive system. Because we now know that most people, not everyone, again, there's always the outliers, but what we're showing and what the research is showing is that most people will get three peaks a day where we are digestively primed to receive food. So if we put good anti-cancer nutrition into the bodies at those times, we extract the nutrients more effectively, we digest the food more effectively, we assimilate the nutrients into the tissues more effectively. So we get, even if it's a 15% improvement, a 10% gain, that's a cumulative day after day, a very, very big gain.
Yes.
And chronobiology explains that. It explains because it's the rotation of the planet and the melatonin and cortisol that dictates when those digestive spikes occur. So if we eat at those times, we get more benefit from the food we eat. If we digest more effectively, then our gut is cleaner, our microbiome is working more effectively, we've got less toxicity in the gut. We know that gut toxicity suppresses the immune system. We know that a clean gut facilitates a higher level of immune counts in certain populations. So suddenly you can see how just tweaking when you eat. So if you just eat two changes, if you go to bed at the right time and you remove the blue light, and suddenly you tweak your meal times so you're hitting those generalized peaks, that could be a huge gain as you extrapolate that day by day, week by week, month by month, in terms of nutrient loads and gut health and all the other bits and pieces. And that's what chronobiology gives you. It gives you that ability to take what's good and make it a lot better, or to take what's bad and try and antidote it. I think particularly in the cancer context where diet is so important, if people are going to the effort and the cost and the time to prepare and research and use very, very good food, then you want to make sure you're extracting every single molecule of that good food, and arguably the best way of doing that is to eat it at the right times.
Really interesting. Okay, so you just mentioned there how the people have been studying these pilots who are completely messing with their biological clocks by what they do. The kind of ultimate in that, which I think has also been studied quite in depth, is people who are night shift workers and who deliberately do exactly the opposite of what we're supposed to do. What goes on there? What's the effect that's been noted?
Yeah, so it's pretty much it's always a tricky one, because I think that kind of research is challenging, because if you're a night shift worker and you've got to pay the mortgage and you've got to do it, and sometimes knowing the damage it causes is almost worse than not than not knowing.
Right.
there's always the outliers and the anomalies, but if you go on, and this has been studied since the 80s as well, going back to 1983 around night shift workers, but the weight of the evidence is really clear, that people who work night shifts or rotate between day and night, they have suppressed immune systems, they have higher infection rates, they have a higher prevalence of depression, they usually carry more body fat, they usually have higher blood sugar profiles, they usually have higher cholesterol. There's dozens of parameters that are predictive of good health or disease, and generally night shift workers or shift workers have a worse index on those than people who don't. And I think in light of the evidence around how the circadian rhythm works, I think it shouldn't really come as a surprise, because we're working when we should be sleeping and we're sleeping when we should be awake. Whatever way you cut it, and I think so much of, I talk about this quite a lot in our workshops and courses, but so much of, I think, what allows us to understand what makes us healthy and what makes us ill is looking back to how we designed to live. Since the Industrial Revolution, it's only the last couple of hundred years that we've lived like this. For most of our evolution, we've lived in a much more natural way. And we are not designed to be working and be stimulated at 2, 3, 4 in the morning. It's just the nature of the beast, and anything that flies in the face in that will usually be a penalty, and for a lot of the time that will come in health or particularly mental health, depression, breakdown, things like that. It paints quite a bleak picture.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
All these things are a kind of statement by human beings that we can do what we want, that we can free ourselves from nature in a way, and in a way we can, but as you say, there's a price to pay, that ultimately we can't. We are part of nature, and it will affect us whether we like it or not.
Yeah, and we can kid ourselves, and we can use energy drinks and coffee, and we can use melatonin supplements on prescription to get to sleep, but again, that's what we do. We're the most amazing problem solvers, aren't we, as a species? And we've got to the point where we're so adept now, we're so expert at problem solving, we're not looking at what's causing the problem in the first place. Like I mentioned this earlier, but it's that sense of, rather than solving the problem, take away the problem, try and just honour the way our genetic profile is telling us to live. And it's not, I think one of the things around chronobiology is it's not difficult. I mean, if you look at the science, they're saying there's three key points that dictate most of the other points. When we get up, so cortisol begins flooding into the blood, it's 5 in the morning, peaking at around 6-ish, 5:30, 6 in the morning. If we're getting up, it's slightly different in winter, daylight saving affects it, but if we're getting up between 6 and 7 in the morning, we're getting up and we've got abundance of get up and go hormones. If we get up at the right time, it usually means we'll eat at the right time. So breakfast, they're saying we get the first digestive spike of the day between about 7 and 8:30 in the morning. So you're hitting breakfast there because you've got up at the right time. Digestion then plummets until it rises again between about 12 and 2 in the afternoon, and then drops down again until it rises between about 5:30 and 7:30 in the evening. If you're eating at those times, you're digesting well, you haven't got food sitting in the gut making us tired, and if you're eating at the right time, if you're eating by 7:38, you're ready, you would have digested, and you're ready to go to sleep by 10, 10:30, 11. If you've got up at the right time, you should be biologically tired by that time of the evening because you had a good full day. Melatonin's right, you're not looking at blue light or anything that's disrupting melatonin. So you go to sleep, fall asleep quickly, have good, deep, restful, immune-boosting, stimulating, repairing sleep. So you wake up again at 6:37, whatever it may be, you feel revitalized, energized, and it just goes on and on. And those things, they're not drastic changes. They're simple things, but cumulatively they give. Or again, in the Ayurvedic framework, they say living one day in bliss, one day where you're doing everything right. You've got the timings right, you're embedding certain self-care techniques, whether it's meditation or yoga or massage or whatever it may be, and suddenly we can take, within 7, 10, 14 days, we can take our physiology from being substandard with lower immune counts and more inflammatory markers and suboptimal hormone profiles, and just through living in keeping with the planet rotation, just by embedding self-care, 2 weeks later, you could be living in a body that's gone from suboptimal to absolutely optimal. And it's just required a small tweaks here and there. It hasn't required anything that costs money or that is too laborious. And that's why I love that simplicity of it. And I love the fact that you can then quantify the gains it gives you. And it's a cumulative gain, so it's the gift that keeps on giving, I suppose. It just gets better and better. So I think it's definitely something that's worth exploring, particularly in the context of cancer survivorship, where immunity and nutrient assimilation and sleep and inflammatory markers are so important. It's a no-brainer, really, to try and understand and try and embed these approaches.
Well, great you brought it back round to cancer again, because of course that's the subject of the show. I want to ask one thing about, I believe there's been some experimentation with the concept of working with the body clock when treating cancer, administrating treatments in a way that takes advantage of the cycles of the body. I don't know much about it, but can you tell us anything about this?
Yeah, it's fascinating. So I think it was in Munich, they did the biggest study on this. And it's exact exactly that. And I think the implications for chemotherapy, this is, I think it was in 2016, so it's still probably not translating through to actual clinical practice, but I think it will, because so in one of the trials, the big trial, they looked at when to administer and deliver chemotherapy. So chemotherapy obviously works by targeting the cells that are dividing most quickly. Mm-hmm. So cancer cells, stomach lining, skin cells, nail cells, etc. Which is why you get the classic symptom profile of chemotherapy. So what they said is when cancer cells will proliferate usually at the same speed 24 hours a day, because they're flawed. They don't necessarily follow the chronobiological patterns.
Right.
Whereas all the healthy cells will. So what they said, if you're putting in drugs that are identifying and destroying fast-growing cells, what you want to do is put those drugs into the body when all of the naturally healthy fast-growing cells are slow, but the cancer cells are still fast.
Mm.
Because if you do that, the chemotherapy will latch on and attach and destroy more of the cancer cells and leave the other healthy cells alone, because they're not dividing it quickly enough to attract the attention of the chemotherapy.
Oh, interesting.
And that's exactly what they did. So they looked between 5:30 in the morning and 10 in the morning. So it was a 4 and a bit hour window, which is what they isolated when the linings of the lining of the stomach, so the gastric linings, the skin, all of the hair follicles, where those cells were dividing at a much, much, a significantly slower rate. They administered the chemotherapy during that time, and what they found was exactly what you'd expect. The symptom profile was lower. There was less nausea, there was less hair loss, there was less nail dysfunction, less skin dysfunction, but it didn't have any impact. It didn't reduce the impact of the chemotherapeutics on the cancer cell activity. So, you know, and also there were lots of subtle benefits to doing that, because it was a qualitative study as well. So they interviewed the patients, and what they were finding was by asking the patient to get to hospital at that time, because it was earlier, suddenly they didn't have to drive around trying to find a parking space for half an hour, which means their stress levels were less. The hospital was quieter and more relaxing, so they didn't feel quite as head up and pressurized as they did at a 2 in the afternoon appointment.
Right.
It was calmer, quieter. There's all these benefits, and it's hard to delineate those, because it might be it wasn't just when they delivered the chemotherapy, it might be because they were, you know, in a more relaxed state, whatever it may be, but it was a bit of a win-win. So I think, and also that's looking at it from chemotherapeutics, but there's probably implications in lots of other areas of medicine,
yes.
Other drugs, even surgical intervention. You know, I think again, it's probably why chronobiology is getting so much funding, so much coverage at the moment, because it's literally just scratched the surface of where are the ramifications of this? Where do they stop? Because it could affect medicine, pharmacology, surgery. It could have implications that are beyond what anyone's even beginning to understand at this point.
Yeah.
So there's definitely implications on administering chemotherapy and the side effects and benefits from doing so, which is so exciting. There's huge capacity there to help, I think.
Hmm. Well, really interesting. And of course, it must ripple out and have an effect on the prescription of integrative approaches as well. There's almost bound to be better times to administer those as well. But it's a huge amount to be found out before we'll know really what the best thing to do is.
Yeah, that's it. And there's always, like all things human, there's always going to be capacity to individualize, because I think, you know, All new approaches have got problems and criticisms, and I think one of the very, very valid and just criticisms of chronobiology is this idea of it's making it too generalised. It's saying, yep, this works for 70% of the adult population, that's enough. But you can't do that whilst discriminating against the other 30.
No.
So we still need to understand how does the person in front of you, how is their profile different, and how do you use that as to help them rather than to hinder them? So there's all these question marks, and I think it's just going to take time for those to filter down, more funding, more research, more science. But it's probably only going to get better. I can't see how it's going to regress. I can't see how this is going to get this is going to be an issue or a construct that's going to become less used or less well known or less impactful. I just think it's going to get more and more and more widely known about, which is great, which is what it should be.
Absolutely. All right, so we're out of time now. A really fascinating subject. I mean, you know, what a lot to talk about. I mean, I've sort of scratched the surface really on the things I felt we could talk about. It's, as you say, it's so far reaching that it has so many implications on the way we live and on the way we look after ourselves.
Yeah, it does. And I think anyone listening, just if you just pick up one thing, if you just pick up, you know, modifying when you get up or when you eat or when you go to bed, just that one subtle change can have, you know, the science shows it can impact upon all of those variables you spoke about. So, yeah, and I love it. I love that simplicity. So, big impact. So there's lots. Yeah, I mean, there's lots of things that we haven't discussed, and there's lots of other implications. But no, it's been great to talk about it. Thank you for inviting me back onto the show. It's a real privilege. So, yeah, I'm very grateful. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Watts is absolutely passionate about integrative medicine, as was abundantly clear in our talk. So do make a point of following his social media and blog posts. Thanks for listening today. I look forward to bringing you another Yes to Life show next week here on UK Health Radio. Goodbye. Thank you.